You're listening to Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio. I'm Heidi Holton. Joining me in the studio, Aaron Brown, our liberal commentator, and Chuck Marone, our conservative commentator. And we continue this conversation about immigration and immigration today. And we wanted to kind of start this. I know, Aaron, you have immigrant students very often, and kind of start there on sort of a personal level and move into policy, politics, and what's going on
today.
Yeah,
well, I teach at a community college, and I teach a class that everyone has to take even though they don't want to, which is in communication, public speaking. And as a result, I get to see a cross-section of whoever's going to college and whoever's going to tech school. I see everybody. I don't pick them. They don't want to be there, well, quite often. So what's nice about that is that you get a true picture of a community that way. And one of the things that has happened, it's just been happening across the state of Minnesota, is that we have a growing immigrant population in this state. And we tend to associate that population with the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the northern suburbs, places like Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park, and other places. Maybe a few towns where there's a meatpacking plant or something. But what's happened is that those populations have grown such that there's demand for things like, for instance, college education, training for jobs that are now full in the Twin Cities. They're full. And we offer the training here in northern Minnesota. And so people are saying, hey, the opportunity is there. And so you're actually getting immigrant people coming to Hibbing, coming to Grand Rapids, coming to Virginia, and taking classes to prepare themselves for work in their new home in the United States of America. And that's been a great opportunity for me and for the people who attend our college, because we're getting to meet people from all over the world. So when I talk about culture, our conversations can expand a little bit beyond hunting and fishing and what we know of the Iron Range into some other ideas and really understand what it's like to understand your culture and how many different cultures there are in the world. And so that's been a really cool opportunity. But I've also gotten to meet some really cool people who are doing cool things. And I've had David Lauer from Liberia was on the Great Northern Radio show last fall. He's still there and he's worked his way through college in a lot of different jobs. And he works in the maintenance staff at the college. So you see him everywhere because he's always doing stuff around the campus, and a very intelligent guy, and he's working with a large family, and they're all trying to find their way into this new place where they plan to live and work. What's remarkable for me is it gives you the opportunity, even though David might not look like my ancestors, how similar the story is, and then how the way the immigrant debate is framed in our country, applying to people like David, would then maybe have been applied to our ancestors as well. And maybe we can learn something about the history of our policy and how it relates to the present of our policy. So I just think that's really remarkable. And Chuck, you travel all over the world too. And yeah. I know you get a lot of experience talking to people about this issue.
Let me put a nuance on what Aaron said. I hear exactly what you're saying. And it's the same as my experience. I want to quote a Scottish economist named Mark Blyth, who's a fascinating guy. He works at a university in Rhode Island, and he made this point on immigration. He says, immigration for me and for my colleagues and peers is always a great thing because it means I get to meet a really interesting person with a PhD from a different land.
Yeah.
You know, like I get to meet like the smartest guy from this Indian village who's now here and who can talk to me all about what it's like to be there, which I've never been, and also has a PhD. So very intelligent person. We have a common language. I'm listening to your story and I find it compelling. I hear what you're saying. My interaction with people who would identify as immigrants, and I would say a lot of people who are from, you know, urban areas where a lot of the immigrants are professionals, you start with a common language, which is not necessarily, I'm not even talking about English. I'm just talking about I know a lot of engineers that are immigrants. They're fascinating people to talk to. We both know calculus. We both deal with numbers and technical stuff. You know, we have essentially like a common bond in the sense that we have this shared set of professional experiences, let's say. I think it's a different conversation, and it's a more, I think, human and interesting conversation. And I think maybe a more tense conversation too, when you're talking about people who are not in that, and let's just, for the sake of the discussion, use the term privileged class. If you're coming here as a poor worker and you're rubbing up shoulders with a poor worker from the U.S., the places of intersectionality are way different than two PhDs chatting with each other, or two college professors, or a college professor and a college student chatting with each other. The relationship is very different, and different in ways that I think make it more difficult in a lot of ways. You are not challenged career-wise at all, real or imagined, by a really good foreign student. I am not challenged professionally by a really great foreign engineer or planner coming here and working. They only make my life better in many, in cultural ways and other ways. If you are someone who is working at an entry-level job as a meat packer somewhere, or you're trying to get the job and, you know, have one at Super America and also at the hotel cleaning beds, and you're trying to make ends meet with two or three jobs, there's a certain degree of tension with this, like, different person now who I don't have that common bond of a language the way that a professional would. And I think sometimes that's lost in our conversation, because those things are, in a sense, a very human, and I think a very much part of, like, what our conversation is based off of today.
It kind of comes down to a human chemistry experiment. Immigration, broadly speaking, was and remains, well, obviously it's the reason there is an America for a thousand reasons, because the question of unskilled labor is not a new one. When we talk about the history of the Iron Range or industrial cities, we're talking about unskilled workers who they would just, here's the machine, put the stuff in here, watch, they'll clip your hand off, and the last guy lost his hand, that's why you're here, you know? And the workers who did that kind of work are forebearers in the Industrial Revolution, who were, many of our ancestors were immigrants, and this was them. You know, the unskilled labor of today, well, those kind of jobs have been changed and automated, and now the unskilled labor is, like Chuck mentions, the gas station worker, the fast food worker, the service worker, the meat packer, the people who do those jobs are the unskilled labor. And one of the questions is, what does an influx of unskilled labor do in these fields? Does it help to have these people there? Because maybe Americans don't want to do, like picking, for example. We have a family friend who is a farmer in Wisconsin, and she hires migrant workers to pick, harvest every year. This is not unusual.
Not unusual today, and not unusual throughout human history.
Yeah.
Right.
Her response is that they work extremely hard for the period of time that you need them, and they do a good job, and it's a wonderful arrangement for her, because it's what they do, it's what they know, and that they come as a unit and get the job done. And so on one hand, immigrants who are hungry to prove themselves in a new land, who want the money and land that our ancestors wanted, are a good thing for the workforce. But they can be a bad thing for wages in those entry-level positions. They can create a competitive element that leaves a lot of people left out. And that's the chemistry that we're talking about here, trying to balance that and create a social system in a messy, you know, Chuck mentions this being a messy history. It's an extraordinarily messy history, politically, economically, socially. And the strife is all around us. And so when we hear about immigration being a controversial issue and one that provokes just these profoundly angry and just very vitriolic responses, it has to do with that threat of that most primal thing, which is our ability to make money and provide for our families.
Well, let's talk about humans a little bit. I'm sorry, yeah. Did I interrupt?
Well, I was going to say, and maybe we'll move into this, but I've had the chance to be at a few community meetings where people are talking about immigration and their fears. And one of the things that comes up, and I think you are talking about this, is the economics of it. And there is this idea out there that a lot of people believe that jobs are being stolen, that Social Security is being jeopardized because of immigrants coming to our country. And they're very, very afraid for their own economics there. And I think some of what they're hearing, a lot of what they're hearing in the media, backs up those ideas.
Yeah. Well, let's deal with that very quickly. Because I do think there's this interesting underlying tribal dynamic that I'd like to talk about. But the economics, there are all kinds of economic studies looking at this. And you can get people who say, in a macro sense, immigration is great for us. It provides churn in the economy. It grows the overall GDP. It creates cheaper goods for people, for consumers. All of those things, I think, are likely true. I think the economist is it. The difference is, and we've talked about this in other episodes with other issues too, there is a tension between what is good for the macro economy, and you can almost think of that as what is good for the broader middle, upper middle class, and what is good for an individual, household, a family, a person. And what our macroeconomic policies tend to do when they aggregate statistics over this broad thing is say we are, in a sense, willing to sacrifice the individual a little bit if it makes the collective economy better. And I think there are good reasons for people with spreadsheets and ivory towers to make that case. And I think maybe looking back at the course of human history, we're all better off today because of that trade-off that's been made for hundreds of years. That still doesn't make it any easier for the guy today who can't make a living at a job, wishes the salary and the wages for that job would go up, and can't help but understand basic economics that if someone's willing to come in and work at that job cheaper than I am, the wage is never going to go up. That's a natural, I think that's an economic reality.
I think that's a very real feeling that people have. What's challenging is that that's not always necessarily true. What they see it that way as a direct threat, but quite often immigrant labor isn't necessarily taking job for job jobs from Americans. In fact, it's really hard to point to a specific job, especially here in northern Minnesota, where people talk about immigration a lot. I think if you polled people in northern Minnesota what their big issues are, I wouldn't be surprised to see immigration top five, top three, maybe even near the top of the whole thing as an issue that people are talking about because it's such a national issue as well. But to point to a job that I lost my job because immigrant person here took it and worked for less, it's really hard to find examples of that. Really hard to find examples of that. There's a great poem about Mexican migrant labor from the 1970s that talks about that, that, you know, name the job, show me the job that was taken away. What it does, though, that is real is it creates, you know, where studies have showed that there is problems is in the macro level where you talk about large numbers of people suppressing wages in certain industries, which is interesting because when you look at labor, we've talked about labor in the past and where are the advances in the labor movement going to come? Where do they need to happen? I think it's one of the interesting things is like the service workers are one of the most, they're like the front lines of the true labor movement. A lot of it is immigrant. You know, because it's the immigrants who are taking the low-wage jobs and now want some equality in their wages. In a way, I would make the argument that that fight is good for all workers. That is the fight that our ancestors, the people here, the three of us in this room, talk about, certainly mine anyway, in working in the mines. And so it's hard to understand, and I think there's a lot of perception over reality in the way your average worker might look at this.
Right. And I think at the end of the day, you do have this tension in that work group. Right now, from a macroeconomic perspective, we have massive global wage deflation. We have wages dropping around the world because there are people in India who will work for a dollar a day and they're not incompetent. They're not dumb. They're very capable of doing good work. And so we see international companies moving to places where they can get cheap labor. And what it's done is it has had this global macro downward pressure on entry-level wages. It has also created, and we talked about this a couple episodes ago, it's created the fact that you can buy clothes for $5. You can live off of essentially less money. You can consume food year-round, grown all over the world, that is historically ridiculously cheap. So if you are a person at the low end of the wage spectrum in this country, it is a very kind of simple calculus to say, the fact that someone will come here and work for $8 an hour and I need $12 an hour to make ends meet, that's hurting me. That's like a very easy thing to say. Also, the fact that, you know, you can buy clothes really cheap and food really cheap, and those things are all helping you. And the macro people say that evens out. I get that macro argument. It just doesn't make it any easier for the person who's living that life.
And the macro argument has always been the one that has prevailed.
It is. Because the people making it have the money.
Well, right. But like looking at American immigration, again, going back to what we talked about in the last episode, the early 1900s, who are the people for immigration in 1910?
The business owners.
And the only people were the owners of the mines, the owners of the factories, the Rockefellers of the world enjoyed, and they could encourage immigration. They could sift through and take the workers they wanted out of the masses that were coming, and they could try to, Americanizing these immigrant laborers was actually one of the company's goals. And actually, they found it very profitable to work with that population. And they had techniques and tactics that kept them from unionizing, that kept their wages at a controlled level until they woke up as people and realized they had rights and then fought back a little bit. But I look back at the Farmer Labor Party history, one of the most radical third parties, successful third parties in America, here in Minnesota, period of time through the 20s and 30s during the Depression especially. They ruled the state of Minnesota. They were an alliance of two groups that didn't have a lot in common: rural farmers, who were essentially small business people who grew crops and sold them, and in urban industrial workers who didn't own any property. They rented, they had nothing except their ability to work. Their work was being exploited, and the farmers' ability to produce crops was being exploited by high-level capitalism. That party, as radically liberal and progressive as it might have been, had a very strong anti-immigrant plank in its platform when it was founded. And in fact, even though the people in the party were first or second generation immigrants, they saw what you're talking about on the micro level and were really concerned about it, especially those industrial workers in the cities. I hear that in the political debate today is like, well, what the DFL has abandoned their farmer labor roots, the rural and urban workers working together. Well, that was an unnatural arrangement from the start, and we now see that, you know, family farms are not extinct but highly endangered, and corporate farms own the farmland now. In the industrial cities, the descendants of those original workers that were in the Farmer Labor Party are now wearing suits and ties and selling insurance, and the people who rent and who are displaced by capitalism most often are the very poor and quite often immigrant, you know. And so we have this history of trying to do something for those workers, but then, you know, ultimately that big macro argument always seems to win, which is why I think you see this backlash that's been forming lately.
I know we're going to switch to policy in the next segment, and I do think it's important to, as maybe a segue to that, just recognize that the Democratic Party used to have a very strong anti-immigrant wing, and it was based on this labor contingent. As labor, and let's be more specific, union labor has changed from being blue-collar workers to government employees and white-collar workers that are unionized. The sentiment of the party has changed. And I think the interesting thing, and the interesting thing from a public policy standpoint, is who is going to champion these workers. The Republican Party is not a natural place for them, but the Democratic Party has started to treat them more as victims as opposed to people that they can empower in a labor kind of way. And I think that they are, in a sense, very much up for grabs in this public policy conversation.
You're listening to Dig Deep on KEXE, KBXE. We continue immigration in our next segment. You can also sign up through iTunes for a podcast.
Et d'une chanson d'amour, la mer a bercé mon cœur pour la vie, a bercé mon cœur pour la vie.